Jack silently thanked the Parodendron who had saved them from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Thanked him.
That's right. Annie put the dinosaur back with the other books. Then she gasped. Wow, she whispered, look at this. She held up a book about
dreams. Books are each a world, and books, we know, are a substantial world, both pure and good. That according to William Wordsworth. Logan Pearsall Smith had this to say on the topic. People say that life is the thing, but I prefer reading. I can agree with that. The Tiger Eye Reading Room is a dedicated space on the ground floor of Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri campus. In the reading room, youth services librarians in training and early childhood educators create story times for preschoolers enrolled in the Child Development Lab program. It's a magical experience that does not translate into statistics or outcome measures or any other quantifiable evaluation system, but it is a microcosm of and almost complete justification for the entire cycle of authorship, publishing, reading, and librarianship. The Tiger Eye Reading Room series of interviews and discussions brings together all aspects of this cycle. We will be talking to authors, readers, booksellers, children, reading adults, and the occasional librarian or two. We'll try and look at all aspects of the world of books and see what connections can be made or different viewpoints expressed. This interview was originally done at the annual conference of the American Library Association in New Orleans, June of 2006. Like any convention, there are lots of people about, so there's a fair amount of ambient noise in the background. Only once did it get bad enough that I had to pause the recording before we could progress. ALA annuals are huge, cumbersome, usually in hot places, but also serve as a wonderful chance to talk to authors, publishers, and the folks who attend the meetings. The New Orleans meeting was no exception, and we got some excellent interviews out of the trip. I mentioned this in the interview, but Truth in Advertising requires me to say that I have known Jim Nelson for 10 or 12 years, largely as a member of the Patrick O'Brien Discussion Board, but also a fellow partaker of the occasional barley beverage and quantities of pizza. I also did some bibliographic work for him on Benedict Arnold's Navy, his current book. A bit into the interview, I asked Jim a question, the reply to which cracked me up and very nearly did him in as well. There's a good deal of laughter and barely repressed giggling going on for a bit before we get things back on track. Jim admitted to me after the interview that he had had no idea as to what was going to pop out of his mouth when I asked the question that set us off. And we're still at the great ALA New Orleans meeting. We're talking with James L. Nelson, or Jim as I've known him for several years, who has written both nonfiction and fiction. He's a sailor, a genuine sailor man, unlike me, and has gone to the down to the sea in ships and turned to writing for a living, and as near as I can tell is doing pretty well. He's had a couple of three series going about the Revolutionary War, about colonial Virginia, a couple of books on the American Civil War, and his most recent book is Benedict Arnold's Navy, which is a work of nonfiction. So I'm going to ask Jim about writing, the difference between writing fiction and nonfiction, since you've published in both areas.
Well, there is certainly a significant difference in nonfiction. I didn't realize this going into it, but in nonfiction, you can't make stuff up. And that makes things a lot harder. And, you know, if you recall, a few years ago, Stephen Ambrose gave plagiarism a real bad name.
Yeah.
So you can't do that anymore either.
Yeah, yeah.
So really, you have to actually sit down and find out all this stuff. And, the process of writing nonfiction is very different. When I write fiction, I'll sit down, and the first thing I'll do in the morning is read over what I wrote the day before, and that'll pretty much launch me into the day's writing. And if I need to research something, I'll just stop and look it up. With nonfiction, I can't write that way, because there's so much information you need just for the one day's writing. I'll spend the first 4 or 5 hours of the day just researching the 4 or 5 pages I'm going to write that day. And then in the afternoon, I'll sit down and sort of write them. So, yeah, it's a big difference just in terms of the process, the mindset.
Are you, now, for instance, Benedict Arnold's Navy is not, it's not a work of academic history in the sense that there's a footnote every other sentence and all that kind of stuff, and yet in looking at your bibliography, you've clearly looked at a whole lot of stuff. McGraw-Hill isn't got you writing, again, mainstream academic. I don't know exactly how you'd characterize it. What's your take? Aside from not making stuff up, right. Which you really caught me by surprise with.
Yeah, me too, believe me. in the jargon of the business, you would call it, you know, trade nonfiction. I like footnotes, I like endnotes, and I wanted to do them, and my publisher really said no, because they're afraid that all those little numbers scattered through the text are going to scare people off. It looks like a textbook.
Yeah, it might.
So I did endnotes, basically just notes on sources, nothing too elaborate. I did have footnotes in the book, which were mostly just sort of droll asides. My editor sort of made me get rid of those too. So I incorporated them into the text the best I could.
Yeah.
Because they're just afraid that, you know, the average reader looking at this is going to be scared off if they think it's a textbook. So they, you know, they make it look like they don't want little endnote numbers or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that I'm any more or any less rigorous as a historian as I would be if I was writing for more academic press. You know, I certainly gathered every source I think that I could possibly get my hands on, and so the research is there. It's just meant to not look like a textbook.
Yeah. Who wants to buy a textbook? No, as I told you earlier, I'm about a third of the way through the book, and I've been interested. I mean, I've learned a lot about the Revolutionary War, for one thing, that I hadn't known before. But it did strike me that writing history is really difficult in a way, because you can't make things up. And there's a lot of people out there that either do know or think they know something about your topic. Do you run into in difficulties like that and say, well, thus and such a vessel actually had 32 guns instead of 36. How could you write anything so stupid?
I haven't, with Benedict Arnold's Navy, I haven't run into that problem yet. I did, my first nonfiction book was called Reign of Iron, and it's about the ironclads, the Monitor, and the Merrimack. Now, for people who know Civil War history, they know that the Merrimack was actually renamed the Confederate State Ship Virginia. And I wanted to put that in the title, but again, my publisher said, well, you know, nobody's going to know what the Virginia was, so we've got to call it the Merrimack, if that's what everyone knows. And indeed, a lot of people called it the Merrimack back then. But I got flamed on Amazon.com by someone who said, you know, the Merrimack was a Union ship. What, you know, like,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah,
you know. So that was irritating. They hadn't read the books. In fact, I went to some length discussing the name of the ship in the book.
Yeah.
But, no, I think so far people have been kind with Benedict Arnold's Navy. I haven't had anyone catch anything yet.
Yeah, so. I actually, the Reign of Iron book, I thought you were, I remember the sequence about discussing the name of the thing. Something that I've noticed on assorted discussion boards I hang out on is that people are getting more careful about calling her the Virginia, in spite of the fact that it was, you know, for years, the pop of the Monitor and the Merrimack, all that alliteration going on, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, I think the alliteration probably had a big part of it. It really plays trippingly off the tongue. Though it's interesting, the point you make, and you're starting to see that, for instance, you don't hear people calling the First Battle of Bull Run Bull Run much anymore. I mean, the southern name Manassas has sort of come up, and I guess you know, you see this review of history. That's one of the reasons that I wanted to write Benedict Arnold's Navy, is sort of a reevaluation of Arnold as a an officer and as a man. What you had right after the Revolution was historians who felt that they had to find some precedent for Arnold's treachery. You know, they had to show that Arnold was an evil guy from childhood. So you have all these silly apocryphal stories about Arnold and what he did as a child, and they're in the same league as Washington and the cherry tree.
Exactly.
But Arnold wasn't a bad guy as a child. He wasn't an evil person. You know, he was just a guy. In fact, he was a great guy in a lot of ways, who made, you know, this terrible mistake. He really is, in many ways, he's the classic Aristotelian tragic hero. You know, he is a great man, a leader, a man above everyone else, who falls farther and harder than anyone does. So you're starting to see that sort of reevaluation, and I think even like with these Confederate names now, a lot of us, certainly those of us north of the Mason-Dixon line, aren't quite so PO'd about that whole Civil War thing anymore. So we're willing to be a little more flexible.
Yeah. I thought in the book, you're really hitting the interplay between Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen. I mean, I was just in Vermont 2 weeks ago, and Ethan Allen, of course, this legendary character, the Green Mountain Boys, all that huge legendary history that's built, and yet there's a very different Ethan Allen kind of... I mean, the guy was clearly very canny at self-promotion.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
You know, and Benedict Arnold is kind of standing around thinking, I wish this guy would shut up and we could get on with business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story, because by coincidence, Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen were both charged with going to take Ticonderoga. And Ethan Allen had troops, but no real sort of legal commission to do it. Arnold had a legal commission, but no troops. Now, you would have expected Ethan Allen to just tell Arnold to go take a hike, but I think that probably he recognized, particularly if things went wrong, he could really use this sort of veneer of legitimacy that Arnold gave him. So he brings, and it's easy decision for Ethan Allen to make, because he knows no one's going to listen to Arnold anyway. But yeah, he was a real blowhard. He was a real sort of blusterer, and it flamed out very quickly. You know.
Yeah. Something I found. You wrote Reign of Iron, the Monitor and Virginia story, and the Virginia also figured into the second of your Nathaniel Bowater books.
Yeah.
And was that an easy transition? And I mean, the sequencing, what was the title of the second one, Jim?
Thieves of Mercy.
Yeah, Thieves of Mercy. There's this wonderful description in there of the Virginia burning and two of the three of the characters running around and all, which I thought was probably the best passage in the book.
Oh, thank you.
And so there was a clear relationship. Now, is Benedict Arnold's Navy going to feed into any fiction you're going to write anywhere along the line?
Well, it's possible. As you know, I did a series of novels about the American Navy during the Revolution. And I guess I wouldn't mind doing a fictional version of Alcor Island, though, as Kenneth Roberts did that, and it's kind of hard to top Kenneth Roberts,
so maybe
I'll stay away from that.
it's there's all that kind of uncharted territory in a lot of ways. I mean, the two Civil War books were sort of from the Confederate side of the thing. Two generations ago, F. Van Wyck Mason had written a series sort of from the Union side. There was Blue Hurricane and a couple of others that I read as a kid and can't really remember now. You'd said when you were thinking about the early Bowater books that your publisher thought Civil War would sell really well. Did that turn out to be a good... I mean, you won an award for Glory in the Name.
Yeah, that won the William Young Boyd Award for military fiction, which is a nice thing. It did all right. One of the things, Reign of Iron didn't sell all that well, despite getting excellent review attention, if I might point out.
Yeah.
But I think part of the problem, unfortunately, is that people who are into the Civil War are not really into the naval side of the Civil War.
Yeah.
So you can write 5 books on Gettysburg a year and they'll all sell, but the Navy is not too much interest. And most people who are into naval history are into Age of Sail. So the Ironclad kind of fell into a crack there and did not emerge.
About 3 weeks ago, I was in Vicksburg at the National Park and looked at the USS Cairo, which they dragged up out of the mud in 1964. It had been in the mud for 102 years. And one of the fellows I was with is quite knowledgeable of the Civil War, and he was looking at this ironclad, steam-driven, you know, all that stuff, and he said this was really a fundamental change in the way wars were fought as represented by this ironclad, steam-powered thing.
Yes, yeah.
Nothing was ever the same after the Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. You know, I think America as a country tends to be very innovative. So when you have two sides of America fighting each other, it's hardly surprising that you see these extraordinary innovations. And that's the Cairo was one of the Pook Turtles, one of the city-class gunboats. And they were just extraordinary ships and perfectly designed for their environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
That, you know, shallow draft, center, you know, paddle wheel in the center, armored, beautiful vessels. And yeah, they certainly changed the nature of things, no question about it.
And it was interesting that here's the Cairo, this hugely innovative thing, and in fact the Confederates got it with, as near as I can tell, the first electronically detonated mine.
Yeah,
so there was
yeah.
innovation on both sides of that.
Yeah, exactly right. And in fact the first ironclad ever in America was a Confederate ship, the Manassas, which was an old tugboat that they took the top off and put this iron casement on, and it scared the Union all out of proportion with its real potential.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a piece of junk, broke down all the time, couldn't get out of its own way. But the Union was terrified of this thing.
Well, you know, probably with good reason, because when the Confederates did get the Virginia working, it just kicked everybody's butt there
right.
on Hampton Roads.
Exactly.
And
yeah, and that was the thing that was really startling, is the nobody really understood the potential of an ironclad at that point.
Yeah.
And you see the men on board the Congress and the Cumberland, which were the wooden ship that the Virginia destroyed, as the Virginia's steaming toward them, they're standing by their guns, and they're really not that worried. They've got best men of war crew in the world, most powerful guns. They weren't that concerned. And as the Virginia steams up, they unload a broadside on it, and the shells go ba-ding, ba-ding, ba-ding. And they went, oh, no!
We're in trouble here.
This is bad.
When you're writing accounts like that, like in Reign of Iron, how aware are you of the audience or potential, or are you writing for you and hoping somebody likes it? I mean, what's really the approach?
Well, I think in the initial concept of the book, when I'm first thinking about what I want to write about, that's when I'm thinking about who's going to read this book.
Yeah.
And even more than me, the publisher is thinking about who's going to read this book. Is there really a potential audience out there? Once we decide that there is, then it's really a matter of writing the best book I can. I think most writers will tell you that what they try to do is write the book that they'd like to read.
Yeah.
You know? So I try to keep the pace moving. I try to use a lot of the techniques that I've developed as a novelist in terms of narrative. Of course, it's a lot trickier, getting back to this you can't make stuff up thing. because with a novel, if things get dull, you just switch to another storyline. And you can do that with nonfiction, too.
Yeah.
You just have to sort of be careful to juggle the storylines and keep them going. So I try to use a lot of those techniques. I love the detail. I love the minutiae of the history. And that's, if there's one problem I have, I think I tend to try to get too much of that in. I just love all of it. And, you know, Reign of Iron, I've got the names of the women that sewed the curtains for Virginia. It's like, wow, this is cool. I got to put this in.
How do you, when you're writing fiction, for instance, in the Biddlecombe series, this is American Revolutionary War, end of the 18th century sort of thing, how do you as a writer handle the language problem? Clearly it was a different English in those days. Now you and I both read a lot of Patrick O'Brien, who was an absolute master at, I don't think he was actually writing in the language of his early 19th century people, but you sure thought that he was, because of the words and some of the sentence constructions and all that. How do you handle it? You got in trouble over the word okay once.
Yeah,
you, right?
that was my first book. That was an important lesson I learned. Yeah, I wrote okay, and as a set in the Revolutionary War, and I missed it. My editor missed it, copy editor missed it.
Yeah.
The reviewer of Publishers Weekly didn't miss it. But
I shouldn't have brought that up. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. I admit my mistake here. But you read as many journals as you can, as many letters. Occasionally in journals, people will actually reproduce dialogue, which is a great benefit. The problem has always been trying to figure out how the lower classes spoke. You know, because nobody cared back then what the lower classes had to speak. So, there are plenty of examples of how the aristocracy spoke, or the wealthy class. I mean, there's, all the plays, Richardson, Smollett, Jane Austen, all of these will give you a very good idea of how the upper class spoke. To figure out how a common sailor spoke is a lot trickier. So you sort of find what you can and extrapolate from there.
How about personal names? How do you come up with naming your characters? I'm on a discussion board. In fact, it may have popped up on the O'Brien board a little while ago. We're discussing Foyle's War, the TV series that's set in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
One of the characters is named Samantha. Somebody from the UK comes on and says, "This is ridiculous. That was an almost unknown girl's name at that time. Nobody was named Samantha until the 60s. do you, Fred, or do you do any extraordinary research on personal names?
Well, yeah, I do. My wife's name is Lisa, and I've always wanted to put her name in a book, but I've never found a contemporary use of the name Lisa, so I've never put it in there. You know, there's some names that go back, Nancy, Sally, names like that. A lot of the, particularly when you're talking about America in the Revolutionary War period, a lot of biblical names are very popular. And they're wonderful names, too. I love using Elijah and Ezra and these terrific Old Testament names. So I use those a lot. Certainly there's a concern, and I try, if there's any question, I generally won't use a name unless I found a contemporary example.
Yeah.
But, you're talking about this message board and this guy from England railing about Samantha. Well, what did he say? It was hardly ever used then. Okay, probably true, but hardly ever would imply that it wasn't used.
I'm not sure, but it just struck me as a question. I've lost my train of thought on that. One of the things... I've got a book, I don't know if you saw Wellington's Rifles. It was a story of the 95th Rifles that the Sharp series is based on and all that. And we're winding down, I think, here. And that thing is full of wonderful private soldiers' names. It's a whole great index in the end. And I thought, gee, if you write something early 19th century, there's your name list right there.
Yeah, and I do that a lot. I've got, I come across lists of crew members, rosters, things like that, and so I very often will take names from there. Pick up one of the many history books I have on my desk and just thumb through the index, to find names.
Yeah. How did you come up, for instance, Biddlecombe? Now, is that... is that something you made up? Is there a Biddlecombe family floating around?
There is.
I mean,
actually, Biddlecombe, I borrowed his name from George Biddlecombe, who wrote a 19th century treatise on rigging. I always love the name. It's, George Biddlecombe's name is spelled with an E at the end, and I dropped the E because it looked a little too French for my taste. But I love the name. With the major characters' names, I'll really just sort of just play with different ideas, try different things, and then when it feels right, it just sort of grabs me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Oh, I thought Biddlecombe was aptly named. I mean, just from the get-go, he seemed to fit the time and all that. It was a good name to pick up.
Yeah, and in fact, I'd written about half of the first book. Biddlecombe's first name, of course, is Isaac. And about halfway through the first book, I thought, you know, maybe you should be Nate and not Isaac. And I tried changing it, and it's like, no. By then, he was Isaac.
He was Isaac, yeah. Characters grow on you and assume their own reality.
Very much so.
I've always wondered how real Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin were to Patrick O'Brien. I mean, that's probably one of those things we'll never know now. And I think you have a panel discussion to
go on to.
And I want to thank you, Jim Nelson, for being with us. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'm sure we'll see each other again.
All right, thank you, Charlie. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So ends another session in the Tiger Eye Reading Room. Come back again for more interesting and, we hope, provocative discussions from the world of books. Reading, writing, publishing, promoting, care and feeding in a library. You know where the schedule is posted? See you next time on LIS Radio.